This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 27, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Reverend Jesse Jackson considers a meeting with the Taliban to mediate a peaceful solution to the so-called war on terrorism. More fallout from the World Trade Center attack includes some 100,000 New Yorkers who may now be unemployed. And a peace movement is blossoming in London, despite official support from the government for war. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Some legislators on the Hill are trying to make sure workers being laid off by the airlines get a piece of the federal bailout. Gareth Schweitzer reports from the Capitol.
Over 100,000 airline industry employees laid off in the last 2 weeks have so far received no financial assistance from the federal government, which has instead moved to help the airlines themselves with a $15 billion bailout package. Many industry employees will receive no severance pay from the airlines whatsoever. Jeff Zack, spokesman for the Association of Flight Attendants, is outraged that the airlines are refusing to honor contractual obligations even though they are receiving federal assistance.
Overwhelmingly, people are losing their jobs without any sort of cushion here because the airlines are ignoring the legally binding contracts that they have signed with their workers, even after these companies have gotten hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer money.
Zacks also noted that many Republicans believe any assistance for airline industry employees is simply too expensive. Meanwhile, Democrats have introduced the Displaced Workers Assistance Act in the House of Representatives, which would provide financial assistance, job retraining benefits, and health care coverage to employees of the airline industries who lost their jobs as a result of the terrorist attacks on September 11th. From Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
Riots broke out overnight in Cincinnati after a white police officer was found not guilty of killing an unarmed black man. Mayor Charlie Lukin imposed a curfew last night and has already called for another one tonight.
I want to explain to the citizens of my city that I deeply regret having to do this, but it is necessary to send a clear signal to all of our citizens as to the standard of law and order that we respect and we will insist upon.
Right after the verdict yesterday, protesters chanted, "No justice, no peace." Hundreds who gathered for a vigil for the 19-year-old man who was shot threw rocks and bottles and set trash cans on fire. No serious injuries were reported, but more than 800 people were arrested by officers wearing helmets and garnishing shields before the mayor instituted the curfew. According to reports, the city has not seen such racial troubles since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot 33 years ago. And riots in Northern Ireland have broken out again amidst the UK rescinding home rule and frustration over attempts at peace. Orla Rapple has this report from Ireland.
Overnight rioting in Northern Ireland has left 33 RUC officers injured as more than 50 single shots and two bursts of automatic gunfire were discharged during disturbances on the Crumlin Road in North Belfast. The RUC's Chief Constable, Ronnie Flanagan, has described the incident as one of the worst levels of sectarian hatred seen in 20 years. Mr. Flanagan admitted that some members of paramilitary groups orchestrated the riots. Meanwhile, police reinforcements have been drafted to North Belfast as parents and children involved in the Ardoyne standoff experienced one of the tensest days since term began. The security move comes as the Red Hand Defenders, a cover name often used by the Ulster Defence Army and Loyalist Volunteer Force, issued new death threats warning parents not to take their children to the Holy Cross Primary School. Orla Rapple, Ireland, for Free Speech Radio News.
Nigeria is experiencing heightened religious conflicts between Christians and Muslims. Up to 500 people have been killed on the streets of Jos. Sam Olukoya has more from Nigeria.
The effects of the religious conflict are visible on the streets of Jos, which are now littered with human corpses. Most of the corpses cannot be identified because their relatives have fled the city following the fighting. Conflicts between Christians and Muslims in Nigeria have become quite common over the years following a strained relationship between both groups. The relationship will strain even further with the face-off between the United States and Afghanistan following the terrorist attack in Washington and New York. Muslims in parts of northern Nigeria jubilated following the terrorist attack. Nigerian Christians in predominantly Muslim areas fear that some Muslims will turn their anger on them if the United States attacks Afghanistan. for Free Speech Radio News. This is Sam Lukoya in Lagos.
And finally, officials at the United Nations say the UN World Food Program will be flying plane loads of food for the refugees pouring out of Afghanistan. The deliveries will go to neighboring Iran, Pakistan, and Turkmenistan. The agency has been feeding tens of thousands of Afghanis who have fled years of war and drought. But the numbers of refugees are expected to surge as the U.S. builds its military force in the region. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Taliban government in Afghanistan has denied that it invited Reverend Jesse Jackson into the country to act as a mediator, but a Taliban official said today they would welcome Jackson's presence. The Bush administration has said it does not want Jackson to go and that the time for negotiations has passed. More on the story from Jeremy Scahill.
Jesse Jackson says it was the Taliban that contacted him, inviting him to Afghanistan in an effort to resolve the crisis and prevent what many see as imminent U.S. attacks on the country. Despite the Bush administration's comments that he should not go, Jackson has refused to rule out such a trip, which he says would be a peace delegation. In the past, the civil rights leader has successfully negotiated the release of Americans held abroad, most recently in 1999 when he freed three American servicemen arrested in Yugoslavia during the NATO bombing. But this would be a much larger mission, with all momentum building toward U.S. attacks.
Taliban, the ball is in their court, and I hope that they will wisely choose world court over world disaster. A sensitivity note for all Americans, and thank you, President Bush, is that there are 500,000 orphans in Afghanistan. There are several million widows in Afghanistan. The Russian bombs have decimated that country already. And so trying to rebuild it is a stronger weapon than just trying to further decimate it.
Beyond the larger picture of the crisis, Jackson also said he initially began considering the trip to attempt to free two U.S. aid workers currently being held in Afghanistan. In a related development, the Pakistani government said today it will send a delegation of religious clerics with close ties to the Taliban to Afghanistan tomorrow in an 11th-hour bid to avert U.S. attacks. But on a trip to Chicago today, President George W. Bush made clear his mind is made up. There will be no negotiations.
We are united. We're united in bringing justice to those folks who did the evil deed on September 11th. We're not only united, we're determined. We're determined to find those terrorists who tried to affect our way of life. We're determined to find them and to bring them to justice, and we will.
U.S. and British warplanes bombed southern Iraq again today, but a statement from U.S. Central Command said it was not part of Bush's new war on terrorism. There's no word yet on any deaths or injuries from these attacks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
The hope that calmer, more rational thinking might yet prevail in Washington is being offset by India and Pakistan. The two countries are playing what some consider a dangerous game in their bid to become Washington's frontline partner in the impending attack against Afghanistan. This amid fears that a U.S. strike in this region would spark Hindu-Muslim violence in India. Sputnik Kalambi has more from Bombay.
As the U.S. war against terrorism gathers momentum, India and Pakistan are locking horns and returning to the mutual hostility that has marked their relations for over half a century. The irony is that the two rivals are clashing, although they're both on the same side, with a Western alliance being cobbled together in Washington's war against global terrorism. India was quick to react to Black Tuesday. It offered full military cooperation to the United States even before U.S. agencies had collected significant evidence on responsibility for the attacks. Many Indian policymakers and shapers could barely hide their glee at the historic possibility of a new Indo-U.S. strategic partnership opened by the attacks. Asghar Ali Engineer heads the Center for the Study of Society and Secularism.
They jumped on it, and without America asking for any help from India, they extended their help. And started saying that since President Bush had made a statement that we will fight terrorism worldwide, so naturally Indian expectations were aroused, and they thought that America will help them curb terrorism in Kashmir. But Pakistan is much more important, this fight, to America than India. So I don't think America would at all help India in this matter, because Pakistan will extract its own price.
And Pakistan has, at least for the moment. They seem to have convinced Washington to steer away from ousting the Taliban in favor of the Northern Alliance. The Afghan opposition has been receiving both diplomatic and military help from India. Among the four reasons Pakistan's military ruler Parvez Musharraf cited for backing the U.S., three pertain directly or indirectly to India or India-Pakistan relations. Two of them, namely Kashmir and the safeguarding of nuclear weapons capability and other strategic assets, have direct implications for the hostility between the two states. India is taking comfort from U.S. assurances that the Indo-U.S. relationship is as strong as ever. Small comfort, says Askar Ali Engineer. Washington has its own balancing act to do in South Asia.
With Pakistan, U.S. has one kind of relationship, which is more in terms of strategy, military strategy. With India, it has another kind of relationship, which has more to do with market and business. And both are important for Pakistan, for America. They have to do a lot of tightrope walking to please both Pakistan and India. But I don't think America will do anything at the cost of Pakistan, or will do anything even at the cost of India, because they would like to maintain some kind of balance.
But Kashmir is a dangerous flashpoint. Over 10,000 people have died in 15 years of insurgency in Kashmir, India's only Muslim-majority state. Many more have perished at the hands of Indian forces than of Muslim extremists. Almost all Kashmiri separatist groups have warned the Indian government of supporting the United States. Even pro-Pakistan groups went against Islamabad's directives and enforced a general strike a few days ago. An attack on Afghanistan would have serious repercussions in Kashmir, says Dr. Ram Punyani, secretary of Ekta, a Bombay-based group working towards communal harmony.
The process in Kashmir is very weak, and I do not see any solution to any of the problems which is giving rise to terrorism, barring a democratic process being rooted in that particular soil. So, God forbid, if America does any such thing and attacks, probably we'll be having a lot of problem as far as maintaining communal harmony and maintaining civil peace in this country.
India, like the United States, is strong on retaliation and weak on trying to understand the causes of anti-Indian sentiment in the troubled region. Extremist groups are likely to be weakened after Washington froze the assets of some 18 Muslim organizations suspected of links to terrorist groups. This begs the question, though, says Engineer, why did the U.S. not take this step before?
It's not that they came to know only yesterday that this money is being used by terrorists. So America has its own very complex game plans. So only when America was struck, then they want to curb the extremists. Otherwise, as long as they are doing all this and serve some American interests somewhere, they kept quiet. So extremism is okay if it does not strike America. But it is not tolerable. It becomes barbarism the moment it strikes America.
Meanwhile, the familiar rhetoric of hostile verbal exchanges is back in the subcontinent. Pakistan has put a ban on Indian television programs, saying anyone watching them would be declared anti-Pakistani and anti-national. The Indian Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, now says neither he nor his foreign minister will visit Pakistan in the foreseeable future, although they had agreed to do so at the July summit in Agra. Not to be outdone, India's Hindu extremists are jacking up the pressure for a temple to be built in Ayodhya, where Hindu fanatics destroyed an ancient mosque 7 years ago, triggering massive Hindu-Muslim clashes across the country. New Delhi has just banned the fundamentalist Muslim student organization SIMI, reportedly funded by Pakistani intelligence and supported by Osama bin Laden. Tension is now high in India's northern and most populous state, Uttar Pradesh, as fears grow of more communal violence. Parvez Musharraf may have his domestic compulsions, but so does the Hindu chauvinist BJP, the leading component of New Delhi's 24-party ruling coalition. Its agenda is to paint all Muslim organizations, societies, and states with a terrorist brush and present Muslims as a threat to India as well as to other, quote, civilized countries such as the United States. This sectarian view is crucial to its strategy to win votes by making India's Hindu majority feel insecure. Yet, for all its efforts, the BJP has never won more than 23% of the vote. and neither do all Hindus identify with the BJP, says activist Ram Punyani.
BJP is for the politics of Hindutva, which is basically Brahminical Hinduism-based politics. It is for Hindu Rashtra. It is for Hindu nationalism. While larger sections of Hindus, they believe in the secular democracy. Despite the projection that all Hindus believe in Hindu Rashtra, that is not the case. And majority of Hindus are opposed to the conception which BJP tries to appropriate by saying that it stands for all the Hindus.
But what Indian and Pakistani leaders are losing sight of as they pursue their agenda of mutual rivalry is the likely impact of a large-scale military operation in South Asia. A destabilized nuclear power on India's borders is surely a nightmarish prospect. I'm Sputnik Kilambi in Bombay for Free Speech Radio News.
A poll conducted for London's Observer newspaper shows that 3/4 of British men support what the poll called surgical airstrikes against countries knowingly harboring terrorist organizations. That figure fell to 55% among British women. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has been Washington's closest ally since the airplane attacks on New York and Washington, promising military assistance from London in any U.S. attack. Yet, as James Smoot reports from London, the British peace movement is growing.
Prime Minister Tony Blair has been leading the charge to war in Europe, calling the Taliban an enemy at a news conference on Tuesday. But however bellicose is the Prime Minister, all of the United Kingdom is not ready to march off to war. While President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair are busy forging coalitions to fight a war against terrorism, activists in the United Kingdom are forging coalitions of their own, against military action. Last Saturday, some 4,000 people turned out for a peace vigil in Whitehall on very short notice. Nigel Chamberlain from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament describes the swelling ranks of the peace movement.
A lot of people are very concerned about the implications of retaliatory action. We've had an enormous amount of interest in our office. We've had so many phone calls, so many email requests to know what CND is doing. People want to join together. They certainly want to make a statement about the condemnation for the atrocity which was committed. They certainly want to say that they send condolences to the families of the bereaved in New York and Washington. But they also want to send a very strong message that they want no military retaliation. And we think that there's quite a large section of the British population feel that way and are very concerned about the implications.
One of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament's coalition partners is Globalised Resistance, a UK-based anti-globalisation group.
Well, we're absolutely shocked and horrified what happened in New York and Washington on the 11th of September. I don't think anyone in the UK was unmoved by the events, but we don't see that more death and destruction is going to really put this right. And we don't think that there's a real need for military action against what Bush and Blair have declared as a war against terrorism, a war against the tactic.
Activist Guy Taylor doesn't see any reason to go to war just yet and sees Tony Blair's response to the attacks as hypocritical.
Well, Mr. Blair's whole record has been absolutely shameful. Over the summer, before this tragedy happened, he was beating his way around Latin America, trumpeting the free market, you know, telling people that they got to tighten their belts, and Argentina was facing crisis, but there you go, you need more free market, which isn't the answer at all. He is so hypocritical. He doesn't seem to organise a 3-minute silence for the young kids that die every day as a result of third world debt or easily curable diseases. He doesn't try and value southern lives as much as western lives. And we think the whole thing stinks of hypocrisy. And Tony Blair, you know, really does need to take a crash course in ethics, really.
Nigel Chamberlain is a bit more charitable regarding Tony Blair and applauds his coalition building efforts. But he stresses that the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament is not convinced at the need for military action and that there are other means which have not been seriously examined. Further, he wants evidence.
You know, let's just think a little while. Where have been the United Nations in these discussions sidelined? Where has been talk of international law sidelined until very recently? Where has been evidence presented that these groupings are guilty of these crimes? Well, they're now apparently being gathered, but for security reasons we can't be told. This is not to condone, I hasten to add, it is not to condone anything that's happened, but we do require a little more substance and information to go on before our countries are dragged to war.
Guy Taylor for Globalised Resistance sees the struggle against war and global capitalism as inextricably linked.
At the time of the disaster, standing outside the Excel Centre in East London, which was housing at the time the biggest arms fair in Europe this year, And, you know, we were campaigning against death and destruction. We don't draw a line of, oh, here's the military, here's the economic, here's the political. Actually, these things are very much intertwined. And we were campaigning against death and destruction then, and we are campaigning against the same thing now. It's very interesting to note, though, that the day after the disaster, the TUC, the Trade Union Congress, which was meeting, called off their meeting out of respect for the people that died. The arms fair continued, and actually sales and the profits and the share, the prices of these companies went up.
Unlike US organizations like the Sierra Club, who have called off demonstrations and political campaigns in response to the attacks, globalized resistance does not think this is time to let up the pressure. While the UK public opinion has been polarized by the attacks, now more than ever, people wanting a better world have to keep up action. Guy Taylor sees a duty to history.
And I think now more than ever, the anti-globalisation movement, people wanting a better world, have got a duty to actually put their ideas forward, because, you know, I'm 35. I've, you know, in my politically conscious life, Britain has been involved in three major military interventions. I don't want to spend the rest of my life fighting wars. I want to see a better world, and I think now more than ever we have to put our points of view across. We have to step up our fight. We have to campaign for something where this type of thing will confuse our kids when they sit in their history lessons. They'll be coming home saying, "Daddy, what the hell was that going all about?" I want this to be incomprehensible history to our children.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is James Smoot in London.
The head of the Durham, North Carolina chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People has gotten in hot water with his bosses in Washington. The Reverend Curtis Gatewood earned condemnation from the National NAACP after published reports quoted him saying African Americans should not enlist in the military. Reverend Gatewood now says his original comments were misunderstood. Dave Lipman reports from Durham.
A Durham, North Carolina NAACP leader who urged care in targeting retaliatory strikes against terrorists may have been the victim of press manipulation. Reverend Curtis Gatewood was reported to have called for black people not to participate in any military action. Anita Keith Faust, a member of the NAACP local, has been fielding calls from around the nation.
The Associated Press put out a very, I could just say, outright lie. And I would say that the Associated Press has done a disservice to the community and also has assassinated not only Minister Gatewood, but the members of the NAACP here in Durham.
Reverend Gatewood's public statement was directed against the danger of ill-considered retaliation.
We don't know who did this, who's responsible, and until we find out, we can't rush out blindly and call it patriotism. We have to be just. We have to do what's fair. And what is not fair is to go out to kill people who were not responsible for this atrocity.
In a three-page statement, Gatewood went on to detail historical experiences African Americans have had with U.S. military action.
Before we went to war, we were terrorized. While we were serving, we were terrorized. And when we returned, we were terrorized. That does not mean that he just said this time we should not go fight. He said, we need to find out who is the wrong, you know, the person who did these wrong. But he did list the historical significance of the United States refusing to go to Durban, South Africa.
The reports have provoked a firestorm in the community.
Black people are outraged. Black people who don't know what really was said are calling into the NAACP office and saying that Minister Gatewood does not represent me. Then we have an overabundance of people calling in saying, hey, you were right on the nose. We support you. We've had people call from all over the country congratulating Minister Gatewood, but we do have some people, black people as well as white people. We have white people calling in threatening to kill him and all that kind of stuff.
The National NAACP repudiated Gatewood's statements based on received press reports. Local members are still trying to discover the method or motive for the distortion. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dave Lipman in Durham, North Carolina.
More than 100,000 New York City workers are likely to find themselves unemployed, at least temporarily, as a result of the World Trade Center disaster. About 10,000 people have already applied for unemployment insurance. Attention is just beginning to be focused on the workers of the Mammoth Building complex, those who died and those who survived the tragedy. 70 of the dead were restaurant workers. Mimi Rosenberg reports from New York.
Of the approximately 400 people who worked at the internationally famous Windows on the World restaurant, located on the 106th and 7th floors of the World Trade Center, Local 100, the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, represented nearly 270 people. Of the 70 workers scheduled to work the September 11th morning shift, all perished. 47 of those were members of Local 100.
On Monday night, I worked in the main dining. My busboy that evening was Telmo Albert. Usually we don't work breakfast. Telmo volunteered to work that breakfast shift, and that was the last time I saw Telmo.
Asmat Ali was one of the captains of the waiters and a union steward.
That Monday morning, my sister-in-law turned on the television and she saw the first plane attack Tower 1. She called me right away, and that's when I turned the TV on. While I was watching, the first thing that came to my mind, oh my God, Telmo's up there working. And then I called his wife, and she said that at 9:15, she got a phone call from him saying that a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center and they aren't allowing anyone to go downstairs. And the elevator's out of service, so he's stuck up there. And that's the last she heard of. We had people from all different aspects of life, all different religions.
John Bernieri, another captain of the dining room waiters, discusses the dim prospects of finding a new job because even before the attack, the hospitality industry was already reeling from a decline in tourism.
I should really start thinking about an alternative profession. I'm going to be really honest with you. This industry has been devastated here in this town. You know, get rooms like the Oak Room at the Plaza, maitre d's that have been working.